I do want to start with last week's school shooting in Parkland, Florida. And one of the questions being asked by many people, including some of the students there who survived, is why hasn't Congress addressed shootings like this one with some kind of gun regulations, even things that polls show most Americans agree on, whether it be stronger or expanded background checks, banning bump stocks, assault rifle ban. Do you see any chance of changes like these coming after this latest
incident? God, I sure hope so. I hope so. I mean, you see, background, boy, I was born, my sister and I were born in West Virginia, family of hunters. I still have my grandfather's shotgun that he gave it to me after he died. I was about 12 and still have it. And I got my first BB gun, I think I was 8 or 9. And dad taught me to hunt when I was a kid. And my dad later in life, my mom lived in Florida. He was not a gun dealer, but he was a gun collector. Mm-hmm. And he would buy and sell guns. But he would buy and sell guns to people he knew. And he always talked about using common sense. And everything, including the way, the kind of laws we have for guns. I'm a big believer in Second Amendment rights for people to own and buy weapons. However, there's some common sense things that my dad and I used to talk about that said the idea of selling armor-piercing bullets. He said, you don't really need those when you're hunting deer or a wild boar. He said the idea of folks being able to walk into a gun show and go to one gun dealer, it's a federally licensed gun dealer, you have to provide your background information, everything, and your ID. And if you have a history of mental illness or you have a felony record, then they won't sell you guns. You go to the same gun show to the next dealer over who's not federally registered and buy the same weapons. It never made much sense. My dad doesn't make much sense to me. The idea that people can buy bump stocks and turn a semi-automatic weapon into an automatic weapon, we don't really need that. I'm a supporter of legislation that says if you're on a terrorist watch list and you cannot fly in an airplane, you should not be able to buy a weapon. No fly, no buy. That's just common sense stuff. And if you ask American people how they feel about it, they say, well, that makes common sense. Those are good ideas. And they don't really impede our ability to own and buy weapons. And so most people say, why don't you do that? Here's why. Today, our Republicans' friends are in the majority in the House and the Senate, and they have the White House. And they don't want to change the gun laws. I'll leave it up to them to explain why. But it's a source of concern and frustration, I think, for most American people. I think every time we have a tragedy like this, we've had them for many, many years. Every time we have a tragedy like this, people ask, well, maybe is this what it's going to take in order to get Congress and the president to do something? And my hope and prayer is that this will. And we don't have to do outrageous things. We have to take people's guns away. We don't, there's some pretty modest steps that can be taken that will make a lot of us, including our kids, safer.
Another area that's been kind of a point of frustration because of inaction is DACA and some kind of legislation to protect Dreamers, the undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children. Number of bills came up short last week in the Senate. From your standpoint, what is the path forward from here with the clock ticking on mm-hmm. DACA and the possible deportation of sure. some of these students?
I think a lot of people in this country have actually met people from other countries who've come here, maybe brought here as children, and by their parents, and they've grown up here, educated here, work here, good community citizens and servants in some cases. And there's about 700,000 to 800,000 of them. And the question is, are we going to send them back to the countries where they were born, even though this is the only country most of them ever really knew? I hear from employers almost every day, who say to me, I'm having a hard time getting people to come to work to do a wide range of jobs. I was in a financial institution the other day. They were having trouble getting people who can have the kind of technology skills and can actually do the technology that the banks need. I talked to last week. We had people in D.C. from Central and Southern Delaware who run landscaping businesses. They have a similar problem. You have people who are in the poultry businesses, and they have a problem. It's all over the state, all over the country. Today, about 2 to 3 million jobs that are not being filled. I mean, businesses opened up, people want to work, and 2 to 3 million jobs were unfilled because the folks who are needed to fill those jobs either don't have the skills, the education, the work ethic. They can't pass a drug test. And so in the middle of all of this, the idea that we're going to say, here are 700,000 or 800,000 people. They came here, they're born in other countries. They came here brought by their parents when they're young, educated, grown up here, we want to contribute. We're going to send them home. Employers say to me, why does that make sense? That's like in our naked interest to try to make sure those people stay here and make a contribution instead of going back to where they were born and compete against us. The majority of Americans, three-quarters of Americans, I think, would like to see the Dreamers being given a chance to stay here, not become citizens right away. One of the legislation, a piece of legislation we voted on last week was provided for, I think, a 12-year path to citizenship. And President could have played, I think, a more constructive role than he played on this. President sees himself as a deal maker, art of the deal, and there was just a crying need for somebody to play that role. I've been chairman of the Homeland Security Committee in the United States Senate. I spent a lot of time on the border with Mexico, into Central America, into Mexico, meeting with all kinds of people, Border Patrol and others, and Homeland Security folks. I worked with a fellow named Kevin McLeland, and he is the senior person in the Border Patrol. He's got tens of thousands of people who work for him along the border and elsewhere around the world. He says to me, we don't need any more people on the border. We don't need any more Border Patrol people. What we need are about 3,000 people at the border crossings where there's a lot of traffic, a lot of commerce that goes through. He says we need about 3,000 more people there. And he and I have laid out a whole lot of what we call them, it's technology, but it's force multipliers. We call them force multipliers that would make the 20-some thousand Border Patrol that we have there far more effective. And it could be drones. It's drones with surveillance equipment, airplanes, helicopters. It's the dirigibles that go up 5,000 feet into the air with surveillance equipment. It's boats that can go along the Rio Grande River high speed, boat ramps to launch them. In some places, it's horses in high vegetation where your Border Patrol are up on a horse, you're able to see better. It's all kinds of stuff. It's always better intelligence. It's units, it's stationary towers, it's mobile towers, it's motion detectors, all kinds of stuff. And the commissioner of Border Patrol and I literally submitted this list. It costs less than $1 billion a year, and it includes some money for a wall where it makes sense, a lot of more money for fences, which makes sense. It could be roads alongside the fences, all kinds of stuff that would make the Border Patrol more effective. That would actually enhance our border security. There are some places on the border. I was stationed in the Navy in San Diego for a while. There's places in San Diego where a wall makes a lot of sense, but there's a lot of places where it does not. There's a compromise to be held here, which would enable us to have better border security, which would enable us to meet the crying demands and needs of not just the Dreamers, the DACA folks, but also the employers who would like for them to stay here and work here.
Let's move on to the budget deal that was passed, 2-year budget deal earlier this month. What does that mean for Delaware? What in that works for Delaware are some problems that could arise from that budget deal for the state?
There are a number of federally qualified community health centers in Delaware where thousands and thousands of people get cost-effective, low-cost health care. And think of them as like health facilities. And we've got a number of them in Newcastle County. West side is one. We have Henrietta Johnson up north. West side is also located down here in Kent County, La Red in Sussex County. And they provide health care every week to thousands of people. Whether they have a dime to their names or a lot more money to their names, if they have insurance, that covers it. Otherwise, they can pay for it. But we've basically said, we're not going to let them run out of money. We're going to continue to fund them a little bit more money in the next couple of years. There's a program called CHIP, Children's Health Insurance Program, which is a state-federal partnership that insures, I want to say, maybe as many as 9 million kids in our country. Again, cost-effective and for lower-income folks. We extended the life of that program for 10 years, and it actually saves money. And so those are a couple of things. We have rural hospitals all over the country. We have some rural hospitals in Delaware. One of them, Nanticoke, was facing some real serious challenges. And the legislation we passed for a lot of rural hospitals is their saving grace. So that's some of we have some money that we're pushing toward broadband deployment. we've got, especially in Sussex County, a lot of places where we don't have the ability to get access to the internet. It impedes our economic development and job creation in Sussex County. And that legislation, the budget deal, will help to address that. And there's some we have places around the country. We certainly have places in Delaware where we need some extra money for water and sewer. But we have needs in Sussex County that we're mindful of right now. So there's not something for everybody in that legislation, but a lot of places. I think the best thing that comes out of the legislation is certainly predictability. Instead of lurching from, you know, one continuing resolution to another, if we, every time we have a short-term budget plan, 3 or 4 weeks instead of like a year, what happens is the folks who are working in federal agencies, whether it's military or non-military, they spend a lot of time worrying about the shutdown, getting ready for the shutdown, right, instead of doing their job. So it's inefficient, it's terribly inefficient, it's wasteful. And it's really for the folks, for federal employees, it's demoralizing. And for the military, it's demoralizing. We've got to be smarter than this. And I think we finally have, and without a lot of help from the White House on this one, in the Senate, Senator Chuck Schumer, there's a Democratic leader, Mitch McConnell, Republican leader, they worked it out with a lot of input from the rest of us. But it's an encouraging development.
You mentioned the president. He offered his proposed budgets. How much concern do you have about some of the priorities that were laid out in President Trump's budget proposal? Mm-hmm.
One of the things the president's asking for a lot is a lot more money for defense spending. Mm-hmm. I spent 23 years in the Navy, retired Navy captain. Now my dad, chief petty officer in the Navy. My grandma's a Gold Star mother. I mean, my uncles are Marines and Navy and Army. We know what it means to serve in my family, and so I love the military, love the Navy, especially, but. We spend more money before this $700 billion increase over the next 10 years. We spend more money than the next 10 or 12 nations combined. Imagine that. The U.S. spends more on defense than the next 10 or 12 nations combined. And one of the things I want to make sure we're doing a better job of is not wasting money, whether it's in non-defense spending or defense spending. And one of the big businesses or small businesses have to get usually an audit every year. And if it's not there, there's problems, they get a qualified audit because it's not qualified. Mm-hmm. It says, well, you want to get an unqualified audit, which means no problems. Everything's fine, hunky-dory. And for businesses, and as it turns out, federal agencies get audits too. And the Department of Defense, which has been around since 1947, has never gotten an unqualified audit, which means they were without sin. Mm-hmm. I mean, all kinds of problems, waste hundreds of billions of dollars. Last time I saw, we're about spending about $400 billion in cost overruns on weapon systems in a year. And that's just not acceptable. So everything I do, I know I can do better. And I'll be introducing legislation next month with a bunch of my Democratic and Republican colleagues to just go after areas where we're wasting money. And fortunately, the General Accountability Office, GAO, which is our watchdog, our budget watchdog for the Congress, they produce every 2 years a high-risk list of ways of wasting money on the defense side and the non-defense side. That's going to be our game plan, and we'll just go after those.
You mentioned water earlier, and I know you've been very vocal in your criticism of the direction of the EPA under Scott Pruitt. How much do your concerns about the EPA grow when you look at the situation like the one we have in Blades with the contamination of well water there?
You know what, we have groundwater pollution from point sources. It could be a wastewater treatment plant, could be a chemical plant, could be a laundry. But we actually say it's a port from which the source of groundwater pollution comes. And we have non-point sources, which could be runoff from taking chicken manure out of chicken houses, spreading it on farm fields and things like that. It could be just like it rains and there's like waste on the, right, the pollution on the roads and goes into waterways and so forth. But Sussex County in Blades, they have a small town, about 1,200 people, and their wastewater treatment system is pretty old. And they have a contaminant that's measured in the parts per trillion, as I recall. Mm-hmm. But if you drink enough of it, it can be harmful to health. But it can be fixed by putting in a new filtration system in the place where they treat the water. They're going to do that this week. And the problem with a lot of we have in other parts of Sussex County is there are high nitrates, the levels of nitrate, nitrogen, phosphorus, and it comes, a lot of it comes from agriculture, farming, fertilizer, and it could be have something to do with the poultry industry, or particularly if poultry litter is taken from poultry houses and farmers use it to spread it on their fields in inappropriate ways. So we have, it's a lot easier to go into blades and replace the filtration system, the charcoal filtration system. It's pretty expensive. But when you have hundreds of people or thousands of people with wells, their own individual wells, I've asked my staff, I said, figure out for us, for folks who have high levels of nitrates in their well water, is there a relatively inexpensive way for us to provide filtration as the water comes from their well to as it arrives at their home, so that the water that they drink and maybe bathe in and so forth is pure. And it's like a miniature version for every house that's affected compared to blades, where they have a big filtration filter that they're going to implant there this week.
Are you hopeful that's I guess do these type of concerns make you worry more about the oversight EPA will provide to handle problems like this, to find problems like this, to help assess problems like this?
Well, there are a lot of good people at the Environmental Protection Agency. Their life work is to make sure we're safe, we have public health protected, we have clean air to breathe and water to drink. The leadership at EPA is Scott Pruitt, former Attorney General from Oklahoma. I'm sure he's a smart guy, good lawyer. He should not be the person leading the Environmental Protection Agency. And he's taking him, in my judgment, I think in judgment of a lot of people who know him, who work there, who've seen him, he's taken him in the wrong direction. He'll be there for a while. He won't be there for long. And we're trying to make sure that the Congress, the Environment and Public Works Committee, where I'm the leading Democrat, senior Democrat, that we play the appropriate role that we should be playing to do oversight, congressional oversight, to make sure that the EPA is doing their job to protect our public health and make sure we have clean air and clean water. We clean up our brownfields. We clean up our hazardous waste sites.
Much of what we've discussed so far has been things that have been kind of points of frustration for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And this is an election year. A year in which you're up for reelection. Mm-hmm. You have both Republican and Democratic challengers that have emerged. What do you say to frustrated voters when you go out and ask them for their vote this year?
Oh, I really thank them. I served in our country in uniform, 23 years active in the Reserve Navy as a naval flight officer in the Vietnam War and the Cold War. I love serving. My family have come from that kind of background in the military. I've considered a privilege. I'm fortunate to get an education, Navy ROTC, Ohio State, study economics. And I did my time on active duty in Navy in the Vietnam War and moved to Delaware, got an MBA. And I have not everybody that I serve with has a background in economics or an MBA. I've done economic development work for Delaware before I ran for state treasurer. And I love this state. I mean, like, people said, why did you come to Delaware? I came all the way from California, across the country. I got into, I think, better business schools. I just fell in love with the state. When I was in the Navy, actually, flew in when I was an ensign, landed at Dover Air Force Base on a beautiful spring morning, traveled through the state. I said, oh, man, I want to come and live here someday. And when I finished up my time in the Navy, I got to come here. And got in better business school. I said, I want to go to Delaware. And my parents said, why this? Why they lived in Florida? They said, why do you want to go here? I said, I love this little place. And the people, it's a perfect match for me. Folks here are fiscally conservative, and they believe in balanced budgets. They believe that it's important for us to provide a nurturing environment for job creation, job preservation. That's a big part of our jobs. And they're progressive on social issues. And that's really who I am. And so I found a little state, thank God, where I could be myself. I don't have to twist myself into a pretzel and pretend I'm somebody I'm not. It's who I am. And as it turns out, Delawareans seem to approve this message. So as long as they want me to serve them, I'm happy to do that. I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. They don't want me to do it for the rest of my life. But I feel just a great privilege to serve. I love this state. I love the people here.
Do you feel like voters might be a little bit more demanding this year, that they may say to you, okay, well, you know, DACA, you know, budgets, you know, guns, mm-hmm. you know, what are you going to do? You know, do you feel like you're going to get that more visceral kind of, you know, almost anger?
The amazing thing I felt, especially over the last year, actually since the last election, is greater support here in this state and across the country when people find out what I do than I've ever felt. I have people every day many people every day who come up and thank me for what I do and say thank you for being a voice of reason in a country where there's so much turmoil. He said, we need people like you who treat other people the way you want to be treated, who are trying to figure out what's the right thing to do and just to do it. People who are principled and stick to their principles, but are also willing to work toward reasonable compromises with, you know, Democrats and Republicans and independents. So I think that's what the people in our state are looking for. We have, I call the four C's in Delaware, the four C's. It's sort of like the Delaware way. And the four C's include communicate, compromise, collaborate, and civility. And our congressional delegation, whether it's Chris Coons and Lisa Blount Rochester, or Mike Castle, or Joe Biden, or Bill Roth, or Ted Kaufman, Pete DuPont, I think we all try to reflect and live our lives by those four C's. Whether we think of it or not, we actually do, to communicate and to compromise and to try to collaborate and to use civility. I think the rest of the country needs to have a return day like we do in Delaware every 2 years, and all get together in a horse-drawn carriage and winners and losers together and have a brunch together and lunch and just bury the hatchet. That would be a good thing for our country.